Stay tuned for part two of Casey Luskin's interview with Dr. Stephen Meyer. But first, I'd like to alert you to a special offer about an upcoming book exploring the origins of genetic information. The book is titled Darwin's Doubt: The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. It's written by today's guest, Dr. Stephen Meyer. Right now, you can pre-order the book at darwinsdoubt.com for a whopping 43% off the list price plus free shipping. In addition, just for pre-ordering now, you will get four complete digital books, including one on science and human origins. This is a limited-time offer at darwinsdoubt.com. If you want to save big on Darwin's Doubt, you can pre-order the book right now at darwinsdoubt.com. Now back to the interview.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Redmond, Washington, with Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of the forthcoming book, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. In the previous podcast, we talked about what Darwin wrote in Origin of Species. Now, he recognized that this explosion of animal life was a problem for his theory, and we talked about the problem that the fossil record has posed for Darwinian theory and then into neo-Darwinian theory. I'd like to now get into the origin of information in the Cambrian explosion, how that is also a problem for evolutionary biology.
Well, right, Casey. Well, first of all, it's good to be with you again. And the problem of the origin of information is critical because, as I explained in the book, there's really two mysteries associated with the Cambrian. The first is the mystery of the missing ancestral animal forms. The pre-Cambrian strata are not documenting the existence of the ancestral forms, the transitional intermediates that you would expect on a Darwinian picture of the history of life. But there is a second mystery, and that is the mystery closely associated with the mechanism of natural selection and random mutation. And it's the question of, could natural selection and mutation build these animal forms, and could it do so quickly enough to account for the pattern we see in the fossil record? And that mystery, that problem, became very much more acute in the second half of the 20th century as we learn more and more about what it takes to build an animal. In particular, that to build animals, we need new genetic information and other forms of information that are now being called epigenetic information, information in cells and organisms that are stored in places beyond the genes. So the Cambrian explosion turns out to be not an explosion just of form, but an explosion of information.
The origin of these body plans would have required the origin of a lot of new information, genetic information. Why has neo-Darwinism had so much difficulty explaining the origin of new genetic information?
Well, let's talk about the fact of that first, because I think that's something that's underappreciated in the discussion of the Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion is clearly an explosion of form, an explosion of new ways of organizing animal body parts, organs, and tissues. So we've got lots of new body plans, ergo, lots of new form. But we now know, post the molecular biological revolution and things that have been discovered in developmental biology, that to build a new animal, you need a lot of new information. The Cambrian explosion is not just an explosion of form, it's an explosion of information. And one way to get a handle on that, but only one way, is to think about the number of new cell types that are required. So if you have a fairly simple animal like a sponge, you're in the 6 to 10 cell type range. But to get a more complex animal like an arthropod or a chordate, primitive fish or something, you're going to require many dozens or tens of cell types, with arthropods maybe 60 to 90, something in that range. Now, cell types are distinguished from each other very oftentimes by the presence of dedicated proteins that allow the cell type in question to perform specific functions. So a gut cell, for example, would have digestive enzymes. And enzymes are kinds of proteins, and we know that it takes genetic information stored in DNA to build proteins. So every time you have a requirement for new cell types in order to build new animals, you're also ipso facto requiring new proteins and therefore new genetic information. So if you work the problem backwards and begin to think about, well, what does it take to build an animal? We know a foundational, ineliminable, necessary condition of building an animal is the origin of a whole lot of new genetic information.
So obviously this information has to come from somewhere. It had to have its origin at some point. And the standard view is that neo-Darwinian mechanism of natural selection and random mutation is responsible ultimately for generating this information. But why has the neo-Darwinian model had so much difficulty explaining the origin of this information.
Well, that's one of the things I go into in great depth in the book, because as I'm tracing the mystery of the Cambrian explosion, I start by looking at the different attempts that have been made to explain the missing ancestral fossils. And I end up spending several chapters on that because there have been many different attempts to explain the missing fossils away. But there's a point in the book where I then pivot and say, well, let's look at this deeper question. The Neo-Darwinian mechanism has a problem explaining the origin of form, even if there had been ancestral fossils there. How do you build new animals? And that's where the information question comes in. And one of the problems with the Neo-Darwinian mechanism, as far as a mechanism for generating new information, is a problem that I call in the book the problem of combinatorial inflation. And this is a term that David Berlinsky coined. It's an excellent way of describing a basic mathematical problem associated with any system that stores information, like a gene or a protein or a section of digital code. I use in the book the example of a bike lock to illustrate the problem of combinatorial inflation. If you got a bike lock with four dials on it, 10 settings at each dial, you might be tempted to think that you need to find a combination out of 40 possibilities, 10 plus 10 plus 10. But any student of math knows that actually you have not 40 possibilities, but 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. You have 10 to the fourth or 10,000 possibilities. So even a very short bike clock with four dials confronts us with a big, what's called combinatorial problem. There's lots of combinations that have to be searched to find the functional solution, in this case, the combination that opens the lock. Now, in the book, I have a wonderful artist, Ray Braun, who created a great figure, and you know, we allow the reader to imagine a bike clock with 10 dials on it, where you have 10 to the 10th possibilities. And then I related that to proteins, because in a sense, proteins don't have just 10 dials. A modest length protein of, say, 150 amino acids has something equivalent to 150 dials by analogy to the lock. And yet at each one of those dials, there's 20 possibilities. And so what happens is that as you begin to think about the odds of generating a functional protein, you realize that you've got to search an enormous space of possibilities. In this case, that would be 20 to the 150th power, which computes in base 10 to 1 in 10 to the 195th. Now, in the book, I go into all of the different factors that minimize that problem and also those that accentuate it. One of the things that minimizes the problem a bit is that the recognition that there are many combinations of amino acids that will produce a functional protein. But my colleague Doug Axe, who's extensively researched this over a dozen years at Cambridge University, determined that the ratio of those functional proteins to all the possible combinations for a molecule of a given length is still minuscule. He got a number of 1 over 10 to the 77th power, or 1 in 10 to the 77th. And so what happens is you begin to think about whether or not the mutation selection mechanism is plausible. You have to think about whether or not it is effective in searching a space of possibilities that large. So here's where some simple analogies can really help. If we go back to the bike lock, and you can imagine that outside our building here, there's a thief who sees a nice racing bike and decides that he would very much like to have that bike for his own. And he comes around the corner and he looks at that bike lock with just four dials, 10,000 possibilities. But he's also aware that there's a security guard who makes regular rounds. And so he may have at best 10 minutes to do this without getting interrupted. So the question for the thief is it more likely than not or less likely than not that he's going to be able to crack that combination lock in the time available to him? And this is when you're determining the plausibility of an event occurring by chance, you not only need to know the probability of the event itself, you need to know how many opportunities there are for the event to occur. In the case of our thief, in 10 minutes, he actually does not have a reasonable chance of generating that combination by chance. He's not going to get anything like over 50% of the 10,000 possible combinations. So if you're assessing the chance hypothesis in that case, the idea that the thief would generate the combination by chance alone, you're going to have to weigh the number of opportunities he has. And so if you ask yourself the question, is it more likely than not or less likely than not that he'll crack the combination lock by chance? The answer is, if he's only got 10 minutes, it's less likely than not. If he's trying to crack it with that 10-dial bike lock, it's vastly more likely than not that he'll fail. And so another way to think of that is just think about the probability of the chance hypothesis being true. It's a kind of second-order probability. And as you begin to think of it that way, you realize that it's vastly more likely than not that the chance hypothesis is false, because it's more likely than not that he'll fail to crack the combination. So as you do some probabilistic reasoning of this kind, and then apply it to the question of whether the Darwinian mechanism can search the vast spaces that it must search to find even a single protein in the known history of life, it turns out that you get the same kind of result, that it's vastly more likely than not that the Darwinian mechanism will fail to adequately search a space that large, and therefore it's vastly more likely than not that the mechanism of mutation and selection is false rather than true, and therefore reasonable people should reject it. I develop this reasoning in a lot more detail in the book, but it's one of the main problems associated with the Darwinian mechanism. The spaces that need to be searched by random means are too vast in relation to the time available to search them.
Well, I won't spoil your argument for ID the Future listeners, but I think that in the book it is a really fun discussion when you explain this and go through a lot of the precise numbers and how they came up with those numbers. It's a really interesting story of scientific research and investigation in your book. Now, Dr. Meyer, obviously we now know that living organisms don't just rely on genetic information, but also epigenetic information. And we're learning that epigenetic information is very important. Could you explain to our listeners, what is epigenetic information? Why is it important for building an animal body plan? And why is it a problem for Darwinian theory?
Well, I think that's the other part of the Cambrian information explosion. You have the requirement of many new genes and proteins to service these new cell types that are necessary to build new animals. But especially developmental biologists and embryologists have known for really many decades that DNA alone is not sufficient to specify an animal, that the information in DNA is necessary, but it's not sufficient. And instead, there are other sources of information that are in patterns and targets and cell membranes, sources of information that are in the arrangement of cytoskeletons. There's something called a sugar coat on the outside of cells that is clearly storing information, and that information is necessary for coordinating cell-to-cell interactions. There's a lot of information beyond the genome that is playing a role in animal development. This turns out to be very important because, according to neo-Darwinism, the source of new variation, the source of new form, ultimately comes from mutations in genes. And yet, if genes alone do not produce new animal forms, if genes just make proteins, but we have to have other sources of information to organize proteins into cell types and cell types into tissues and tissues into organs and organs into body plans, organs and tissues into body plans, then just mutating DNA is, in the best of cases, just going to give you new proteins. It's not going to build you a new animal. And this represents perhaps the most powerful challenge to the neo-Darwinian mechanism of all, because it's essentially showing that, let's just put it succinctly, that if body plan building, body plan morphogenesis, depends upon sources of information that are not in DNA, then you can mutate DNA indefinitely without respect to probabilistic limits or improbabilities of the kind that Doug Axe has calculated because of his work on the rarity of proteins in sequence space and so forth. And you will never build a new animal form, because in the best of cases, you'll just get new proteins. And you will not have the information, you'll not be generating new information that can arrange those new proteins into higher structures. So that's a big problem, and it's an increasingly recognized problem by developmental and evolutionary biologists, including many who are decidedly operating within a materialistic framework, but who are nevertheless saying, look, neo-Darwinism has not solved this problem. It's one of the reasons that two leading theoretical biologists, evolutionary biologists, in an MIT book in 2003 said very bluntly that the problem of the origin of form has not been solved, and that neo-Darwinism lacks a theory of the generative.
Believe it or not, Dr. Meyer, actually, you know what I'm about to say, but our listeners may not know this. Us folks in the ID movement, we're not the only ones that have recognized that neo-Darwinism is having difficulty accounting for the origin of this genetic and epigenetic information that's required to build new animal forms and body plans. There's a number of evolutionary biologists that are now recognizing that there's a problem with the standard neo-Darwinian model when it comes to explaining these sorts of things. And I think in your book you mentioned Simon Conway Morris has called that we currently live in a post-Darwinian world, where essentially neo-Darwinism is not explaining things like the Cambrian explosion. We're kind of in almost this Wild West phase of evolutionary biology, where there's a bunch of new theories being proposed. Some of them kind of out there to try to explain the origin of animal form without relying upon the standard natural selection random mutation mechanism. And so I'm wondering, can you maybe for our listeners explain what is this sort of post-Darwinian world that we're in today? What are some of the models that are being proposed? And do they in fact solve the problem of the origin of animal form in sort of a materialistic evolutionary account?
Well, I start the book in the prologue, actually describing what I view as a huge disparity between the public pronouncements in favor of the standard theories of Darwinian evolution, or contemporary neo-Darwinian evolution, and the actual status of the theory in the peer-reviewed technical literature, especially among leading evolutionary theorists who are grappling with these problems. And what you find among those people, among leading evolutionary theorists, is there are a few neo-Darwinians still around. But what you find more often are people like the Altenburg 16, a group of evolutionary biologists who met together to look for a new theory of evolution. You're finding among those folks an open call for a new theory of evolution. Or you're finding people who may not be calling for it openly. They've just busily gotten themselves about the business of generating new theories. And so in the book, after I get done critiquing neo-Darwinism, specifically for its inability to account for the origin of the information, both genetic and epigenetic, necessary to build new forms of life, new forms of animal life, I then look at some of these new post-neo-Darwinian theories. You have self-organizational theories, you have the model of evolutionary developmental biology, sometimes called evo-devo. I had an early chapter in the book about punctuated equilibrium. I told the story of kind of its rise and fall. And then I look at some really current things like James Shapiro's ideas about natural genetic engineering or Michael Lynch's ideas about neutral evolution. And so I look at these models and I find some of them very intriguing, and there's some, I think, some positive elements about many of them. I also critique them, and I think in each case, whatever their other virtues, and they do have other virtues, they typically do fail, again, to account for the origin of the information necessary to building animal form in the first place. Many of them are question begging in that sense. They will identify some real and important processes in biology, but those processes in turn typically presuppose the existence of a lot of pre-existing genetic and or epigenetic information. So I find them ultimately wanting as comprehensive solutions to the problem of the origin of form and information, though many of them have some very intriguing and important ideas and important things to contribute to the discussion in the post-neo-Darwinian world.
And obviously there's a lot of great stuff in your book, Dr. Meyer, but I want to commend this section of your book to your readers especially, because I don't think there's a book out there yet that has looked at this landscape of post-Darwinian models and assessed them and really given lay readers and also scientific readers a paradigm for understanding this post-Darwinian world that we live in, looking at a lot of the different models, comparing their similarities and differences, and then also critiquing their ability to answer these key questions. I think it's a really important contribution of your book, and I hope that our readers will especially look at that section of your book when they read it and realize this is where evolutionary biology is going. This is where the debate is going if you follow the science. And it's not solving these problems, but this is the direction that it's going.
Well, I thank you for that. One thing I wanted to do is to give readers a roadmap of the different ideas that are now kind of swirling around in the field. And it is indicative of a field that's in ferment, and at some level, a field that's reached an impasse. Because these fundamental questions of origin, the origin of form, as Mueller and Newman acknowledged in their 2003 MIT book, are still unsolved. And yet this, the origin of form is the fundamental question that Darwin set out to solve in 1859. And here it is still with us. Mm-hmm. So it is an exciting time to be engaging these topics, because I think a lot of very good scientists are recognizing that it is a new day. It is a post-neo-Darwinian world. And just the number of different proposals and conjectures and hypotheses that have been put forward in recent years is indicative of that intellectual ferment.
Well, Dr. Meyer, I think that we are running out of time for this second podcast. So I'm going to ask our ID of the Future listeners to stay with us for a third and final podcast about your forthcoming book, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. And of course, if they want to order it, they can go to darwinsdoubt.com and order advanced copies at a discounted price. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.